music from Denise Davis, her song Perfect Love. And before that, we heard from Paul Wilbur from his Shalom Jerusalem album, live in concert back about 1995. He produced that. And Stand Up and Give Him the Praise. Also heard from First Call, their song Undivided. Good morning to you. 14 minutes after the hour. It's a Broken Road Radio Monday morning. And as always, we look forward to Dr. Don on Monday mornings. Dr. Don Clark, who is a biochemist, a member of the board at Creation Moments, and joins us now from Garden Valley, Texas. Don, good morning. Happy Monday to you.
Well, good morning, Jim. Happy Monday to you, and hope you're going to have a good week.
Well, I think it's going to be a good week and a busy one. Of course, David is here from the newsroom, and also have a special guest this morning. Abe Hollister is a farmer from the Brainerd, Minnesota area, and Abe, we're going to talk a lot about organic farming and grass-fed beef and raw milk. And first of all, welcome to the broadcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Yes, it's good to be here, and looking forward to it.
Well, we've talked on the air a lot about genetically modified organisms, GMOs they call them, or genetically engineered food, and in particular a lot about corn and soybeans, and some of the recent scientific findings that indicate things there might not be so healthy. And that's led us into discussions on organic farming. And, of course, Dr. Don has lent us a lot of his expertise from the world of biochemistry in explaining how things can go wrong when you start genetically manipulating God's stuff here and start playing God, in effect. You farm in a very specific way, and I'd like to kind of know about that and about your background in farming. Were you raised on a farm?
I was not raised on a farm.
Really?
I was raised in town in Brainerd, yes.
A city fella. Okay.
My mother raised me, and I'm the youngest of four. But when I came to know the Lord in 2001, Christ found me and redirected my life. Actually, my father is interested. I mean, he's got an agricultural background, and he farmed in Minnesota, Alaska, New Mexico. So there's history, you know, genetically. But anyways, I did an internship with a gentleman who was a sustainable farmer and still currently farms with dairy. And then I also worked with him doing fence work. So we traveled around Wadena County, central Minnesota, and put up fences. And through that, God really put in my heart the methods of sustainable agriculture to honor him in it. And so we pursued it as a career. Granted, we don't. I do work on the side. I cannot make a full time living doing it. But that is our goal. I might be 50 or 60 by the time I get there. But that
well,
is our goal.
We hope you do, because it's a worthy goal. Define sustainable farming for us. What does that mean?
For me, it means just putting back into the land, not always taking it. Industrial agriculture has a tendency to go for volume, and they in that process they neglect environmental concerns, just certain concerns. So I think for me, sustainability is putting back into the land, and honoring God in it.
Sustaining meaning that in 30 or 40 or 100 or 200 years, it's still productive land.
Correct.
So yes, that's really a form of stewardship. Where's your farm, and how big is it?
We live south of Brainerd. We're about 6 miles south of Brainerd, and it's we own 10 acres, and then we rent about 60 acres that we run cattle on, and we rotate it every day on some, and then others, you know, once.
Meaning you move the cattle around from pasture to pasture then. Okay.
Yep. And that it's really a biblical model, in the fact that you let it rest, you let the land rest, and then you come back to it. We're on about a 30 to 40 day rotation, meaning they don't come back to the same spot for 30 or 40 days. So you know, you're really mimicking the buffalo back when they ran free in
America.
That's
an interesting point. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're trying to do that, and with that, you know, of course, land needs rest, and then cattle don't overgraze it, and then in turn affect the fertility of the land.
Well, tell us about what you produce then. What do you produce and sell?
We produce grass-fed beef and grass-finished. We just recently changed our marketing scheme there. But the difference would be grass-finished, they were fed a little bit of grain at one time in their life. When we get them, because we don't have a big enough herd ourselves to raise, you know, our own calves. So when we get them, we feed them strictly grass. So we do that. That's our main enterprise. And then we have a few dairy cows that we milk once a day. And then we leave the calf on them. So we milk them once a day, and we sell some raw milk occasionally, as the statute says in Minnesota, to the consumer who comes to our farm with their own container and picks it up for consumption. And then we also have a few pigs that we sell. Yeah, we have about 4 feeder pigs right now that we raise and sell.
Okay, well, let's zero in a little bit on this grass-fed beef and grass-finished beef. Now, when you get an animal that has been raised somewhere else, do you know what it's been fed, how it's been raised?
Yes, you know, these particular animals I do. I don't go to the feedlot, and buy animals that I don't know the history of. Mm-hmm. But these particular animals I do. The gal actually buys milk from us. So we have a relationship with her, and she lives east of Brainerd, and excellent animals. She just feeds, that's her model. You know, she feeds, once at wean, she feeds about 3 months grain, and then we get them and feed them strictly grass.
So. Okay, so that would be a grass-finished animal?
Correct. Yep.
And so animals that you raise from birth would be the grass-fed beef?
Correct, yep, 100% grass-fed. I don't feed them any grain. We do feed our milk cows grain, and we have to go to Luxembourg feed. I've told you this, Jim, which is 65 miles one way to get non-GMO feed. It's not organic. It's transitional. So they're transitioning into the process of becoming certified. So again, it's hard to find the non-GMO feed.
Why is it hard to find? I mean, I'm kind of baiting you. I'm going to talk about government regulation here, and then we'll have Don chime in on some of this too, because we've covered some of this ground before. But what kind of obstacles or benefits do you see from the involvement of state government?
Obstacles are many. I think that for instance, subsidies. When you subsidize a farmer, it makes it difficult for the farmer who is non-subsidized to compete. I think you guys have talked about this before, but you just have a really, really hard time to compete because when a consumer goes to the supermarket, for instance, with beef, they're paying more. They just don't know it, with their taxes, they're paying more because the government is giving that person money.
Mm-hmm. So there's just coming out of a different pocket is what it is. Yeah.
Correct. That's one obstacle. I think that with milk, the regulations are, an obstacle because I can't advertise. Legally, I can't advertise my milk. And I can't deliver it. So that's a huge obstacle because in every state is different. There are states that it is legal, completely legal to sell and advertise your milk. But in Minnesota, it is not. Mm-hmm. So those are just a few that...
Well, Don, does that coincide with your experience, your knowledge of this genetically engineered involvement on the part of the government?
Well, yeah, as we talked about before, the regulation in this case really is hurting the industry, and it's hurting the, as you said, it's hurting the small farmer. One thing that you said was you put your cattle on pastures and you rotate them. Well, as you recall, Jim, we did an article, we did a program by Dr. Savory, Alan Savory, who is an ecologist, and he changed his tune on ecology. The general thinking was, well, if you have too many If you have too many animals on a piece of land, then you know that's going to injure the land and ultimately make it barren. But what he actually found and discovered was that by putting a large number of animals on the land and having them rotate through, it actually it causes the land to grow and to flourish. So you can take desert land, for example, is what is the what he did in Africa, and start putting goats and sheep and mainly goats, I think, on the land, and the grass came back, the brushes came back, and the bushes and everything. So it was amazing turnaround, and I think going back to natural farming techniques or the old ways of doing things is a much better way of farming.
Well, Abe, you'd mentioned the similarity, in theory anyway, to the bison herds that used to range across Central America, really as far east as Kentucky and Virginia and Tennessee. They all had what we call buffalo. Officially, they're bison, but buffalo. But millions of them, and there are descriptions of horizon to horizon herds traipsing through the Midwest, doing their thing, and really producing a garden spot in terms of a prairie land that the farmers came in and then ran downhill over the course of about a century in the 19th century, and then we can get into the Dust Bowl and the whole revolution in farming that took place. But would you agree that the old way is the best way?
Yeah, I would say not necessarily the old way, but I as far as the buffalo go, I mean, really they are a huge part in the soil. I mean, even in Iowa, I mean the fertility and the organic matter that is being. I recently came across an interesting stat in Iowa. There's 8 inches since 1950 of topsoil that has disappeared. So I mean, yes, I think that at industrial agriculture is. I mean, we're ruining our resources, our soil. And yes, the buffalo had a huge impact on building that soil up. And, because they would come in and graze an area, and then, they would leave. And then they would come back the next year. And that grass, I mean, I don't know, you've seen pictures of prairie grass. I mean, it was, you could lose your children in it. It was, mm-hmm. it was massive. So yeah, it's huge. So.
Well, there's other benefits too that I guess agriculturalists have found, at least those that are trying to do it more naturally, in grass-fed animals, and that is that their omega-3 levels are much higher than, let's say, in corn-fed or kind of livestock corralling type of herding of the animals. I mean, I don't remember the exact proportions, but goats, grass-fed, their omega-3s are at least 10 times more, in their meat than had you just, fed them in a confined area.
Well, Abe, tell us the difference between grass-fed beef and what you just go buy in the grocery store and feedlots. What's that picture like?
Well, Don hinted on it. I think, the omega-3s and the CLAs, which I couldn't even pronounce. Don probably could. What the definition of that is, but again, it's the healthier fat, and also it's lower in the bad fat, saturated fat, cholesterol. It's higher in beta carotene. Vitamin C, I believe, and vitamin E. So I mean, it's more nutritious. I believe when you cook a pound of grass-fed beef compared to, say, the store. Let's say you go to the store and buy a pound of regular conventional beef, which was raised in a feedlot, and you cook the two. You with grass-fed, you're left with a pound of burger. Let's say you cook a pound of burger. You're left with a pound of burger, where at the store, I mean, you lose about one third of that. It evaporates.
Oh, my goodness.
So, I mean, and the fact that, just the fact that it's more beneficial for economy. I think that if you had many small farmers producing food throughout the United States, I mean, where are they going to spend their money? They're going to spend their money locally. So I think economically, it makes sense too to me. So,
Well, that 30% is a big deal because, you know, grass-fed beef, when you can find it in the grocery store, is significantly more expensive than their regular product. But if you figure, you know, allow 30% right there, you pay 30% more, you're getting the same kind of transaction, the same deal. If you buy grass-fed beef and support that that small local farmer. Is there a grass-fed beef industry out there that we need to be leery of or in support of? What's going on out there?
Yeah, you know, what the reason we changed our marketing scheme is because we want to be above reproach. I think that a lot of people label grass-fed, and it's really not grass-fed, you know. You know, they've been fed grain, and, you know, there's just a difference. I think knowing the farmer, knowing where it was raised, visiting, you know, knowing the animal, I think is huge, and it helps. So I think, yes, there is some deception within the industry, and I think you just have to be aware.
So how do we need legislation then to produce to protect that grass-fed label?
No, we do not. We just need to be smart consumers and go and, like I said, visit the farmer. Know where your food's coming from. And if that farmer's not doing what you want, you're not going to buy your food from that farmer. So I think leave it up to the consumer. We're not as dumb as the government thinks we are. So
yeah. So what does a person look for if I'm raised in the suburbs and I know nothing about beef or farms, and what do I look for when I go visit a local farmer?
I think you just look for, like, for instance, I think raised on grass. I've been to farms when we did fencing that, you know, just the conditions were horrendous. I mean, it doesn't take, you know, they were standing in their own waste up to their knees, you know. So, I mean, there's things like that. Of course, you're not gonna buy from a person like that. So, I mean, just the conditions the animals are raised in. I mean, really, when you look at a grass-fed farm, if you come out and see our place, I mean, it just makes sense because, you know, the animals are where they're supposed to be. You know, they're getting fresh grass every day. So, I mean, just looking at those things and being aware.
So cleanliness, an orderly farm. People that care about their animals, all those are tip-offs then to the consumer who's looking to maybe purchase grass-fed beef and help support a fledgling industry. Now, I know there's a movement, and Don, maybe you can speak to this too. There are, particularly in the Southeast, I'm thinking Virginia in particular, where there's quite a movement growing around sustainable farms. Does it necessarily mean small farms, or can we have big industrial-run farms that can get away from the dollar motive? I don't know if that's possible. Maybe that's a pipe dream, you suppose? I mean, how many small farmers can make a living here?
Well, I think, you know, that it would be something that one should be able to strive for, even the large farmers. I mean, to do sustainable farming, it sounds like all you need is just some extra pastures to run your cattle on. And let the fields, you know, lay dormant for a period of time. And I don't know what that period of time is. Abe, I'm sure you you do because you're doing it. But it would be, you know, adding some extra acres to probably what you already have. It would seem like it would be cheaper in the long run because you don't have to feed them grain. If you have the cost of feeding your cattle grain for a period of time, that's going to increase the cost of your operation. So if you can just let the land do it, it would seem like it would be cheaper.
The word natural appears again. And of course, in marketing terms, in food, the word natural doesn't mean a whole lot anymore, does it, Abe?
No, yeah. Well, no, it doesn't, no. Because most of the time, I mean, you can go to the supermarket and there's many times, they use it as a marketing scheme, you know, to collect the consumer's mind and so they can buy. They see that and then they think, oh, it's natural, so therefore I'm gonna buy it. Like chicken, for instance. I mean, all the chicken in the supermarket is raised in a feedlot or, you know, in a confinement system. So yeah, it doesn't have a lot of meaning anymore, natural.
Any idea of around this area, and we have some fun with our designation as East Dakota now, because we've We decided to secede from Minnesota, but we still love Minnesota in lots of ways, and certainly the farms in the air. Minnesota is kind of an agricultural state. Mainly down south is where they raise corn and soybeans, but a lot of that is the genetically engineered corporate farm stuff again. Do we still have a healthy population of small farmers that are thinking like you are?
I think that there is a movement, an encouraging movement. I think that, once again, the government has overregulated things to make it very difficult to do it, to put it into practice. But there is a healthy movement, and I believe, to go back to the conversation, you know, can there be a lot of small farmers? I believe there can be if the consumer goes out of their way and doesn't shop necessarily for convenience, which many of us do. I'm guilty of it myself, but shops, you know, for the health benefits of not only the economy, but supporting our local farmer. So I think that's a huge thing. I think the consumer has to go out of their way to get it.
Of course, so. And I see what you're suggesting, and I love the idea, but you know, that takes time to research and visit farms and to go make purchases, even if that becomes your routine. And I'm thinking of just how many two-income households there are, where both mom and dad work, and the kids maybe spend some time in daycare, and others spend it in school, and it's just, you're really talking about a whole lifestyle change here.
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, I think it's a matter of what you value. You know, it's fascinating to look back at, in 1940, 50, 70% of, I believe it's 70%, I don't know the statistics exactly, of the income, the average income was spent on food. Now it's like 30%, and maybe Don can help me out, but I mean, it's changed that much. So it's, again, what we value. And I think in America, we value entertainment and recreation above health and other things, you know, so, and food.
Well, and Don, and we've talked about this globally, too. That's pretty true globally, too. We spend less, a smaller percentage of our income on food here than just about anywhere else in the world, don't we?
Oh, we do. I mean, most people spend most of their income, as I said, you know, more than 80%, mm-hmm. On just food and trying to make a living. And we have grown into a society that is entertainment driven, and we have more disposable income. You know, finding cheap food products in your grocery store. Well, you know, you're eating and your stomach is full and you're not hungry anymore. But obviously, we're not as healthy as we once were either, because of the things that we've already mentioned on this program.
Well, we talked about the Norwegian study of GMO products that was conducted over a 10-year period. It indicates there are certain very disturbing trends in the population generally because of GMO foods, most specifically corn and soybeans. But the problem here is that, one, the catastrophe, the travesty of this is so huge, and the effects so subtle, it hardly gets attention at all. And in fact, some of the science that's been done that indicates GMO foods are not what they're cracked up to be kind of gets buried, doesn't it, Don?
Oh, it does. And you're not going to see it on the national news. You're not going to see it in your, you know, local newspaper. You can find it on the internet, and of course we're finding these articles on the internet, so the information is out there if you're looking for it. And I know that because of the number of hits that we've gotten on this radio program, mm-hmm. We know when we do something on genetically modified products, a lot of people are interested in it. So, and you know, we've talked about one of our recent programs talked about how Europe makes it so difficult for companies that make genetically modified products to even get into Europe, and have banned them in several countries. That even for example, the German chemical company, one of the German chemical companies that wants to get into the genetically engineered agricultural products, they are setting up shop here in the United States.
Yeah, BASF, you mentioned, yeah. And we talked about Monsanto giving up efforts apparently to sell GMO products in Europe because there's simply too much opposition, too many legal barriers to doing that.
I have one question I think would be of interest to folks who want to do the same thing you're doing. How did you get into doing what you're doing? I mean, you said you came from earlier, not on the program, but off the air, you said you came from a city background, you weren't into farming, but then you jumped into it. Why did you jump into it, and then how did you start?
Once again, I did an internship. I worked for a gentleman doing fencing work, and we traveled around central Minnesota to various farms, and through that, he was raising beef and chicken, and through that, I just really fell in love with the way he was going about it, sustainably, you know, putting back into rotating the land, that sort of thing, and it just really, gave me interest into pursuing it. And then later on, I did an internship with this gentleman and his wife in Verndale. We did a dairy internship. We bought our own cows and we milked them there. And through that, again, it spiked my interest. And I just really saw it as a way to honor God and what I did, you know, and the Bible says to, you know, to glorify God in all that we do. So I really saw it as a way to do that. And, you know, I pursued it after that. We came back to Brainerd and, you know, I bought cattle, rented 40 acres next to my in-laws. And just through practice, just doing it, learning as, you know, watching the results, learning as we go. It's just a huge learning curve and process. So that was just instrumental. Again, I knew the Lord then, and I wanted to glorify Him, and through agriculture.
Mm. You know, you mentioned something that was that's of interest to me, and that was internships. It would seem in this internships, of course, we did when I was in the biotechnology industry. We love to have students come by and work for us basically for free. Mm-hmm. And in mission work, we have interns come over, for example, with Orphan Relief and Rescue. We'll have some interns come and help us with the ministry. They get to experience ministry outside the United States, in this case, Africa. But here's another area where internships can help, in this case, get you started. It's like apprenticeship, the old method of apprenticeship, that was the way you learn practical skills. And here again, going back to the older ways seemed to be a very practical and terrible way of doing things.
Well, it's really, and we've compared apprenticeship and discipleship many times on the air here with Doug Greenwald. The principle's the same. It's learning from a master teacher. I'm wondering if the time isn't ripe in Minnesota and elsewhere around the country to have sustainable farmers, the few who really know how to do that, know what it's about and why you do it, start teaching others as kind of an incubator business approach, where people who are interested, Abe, this goes back to the 70s. When I moved back to Minnesota from Southern California, I did it playing John Denver music, reading Mother Earth News and the Foxfire books, and figuring I was going to start a hobby farm someplace. That was really what was on my mind and my heart at the time. But I wound up learning that you still need cash money to get by, which was a real discouragement to this whole thing. So it really boils down to lifestyle and what your priorities are for your life.
Yep, and there are people doing that. You talked about internships. There's a gentleman in Virginia who is, to me, the face of sustainable agriculture, Joel Salatin. I don't know if you guys have heard of him, but he does internships, he does apprenticeships, and that's really his model of teaching these young, aspiring farmers. And then they go out and they implement this where they live. Like, some of them are coming from Oregon, Minnesota, Missouri, you know. So it's huge what he's doing over there. So there are people in Minnesota doing that. The gentleman that I did it with, he's still doing it. So there is a movement. So, you know, I'm encouraged by it.
Well, that's a positive note and probably a good way to wrap up the conversation today, except we haven't heard nary a word from David Allen Punt, who's been sitting quietly by there. David, any thoughts, questions?
Some people think that maybe I'm no longer around.
Well, it could be.
Maybe I've gone. Maybe I'm out sustainable growing myself.
Well, that would be something.
Abe, one of the things that I wanted to find out too is how far south of 210 are you?
I am, let's see, 6 miles, I believe. Okay. 6 or 7 miles. 7 miles, probably. Yep.
Okay, so we're going to have to extend the borders. See, our borders.
That's right. We need to know. We're looking for, now I know you're not certified organic. We didn't talk about that. But we'd like to incorporate you within the borders of East Dakota. Would you have any objection to that?
I would not, no.
Okay, okay. We'll put you down then.
Got ourselves
we'll
a
have
farmer.
We'll have to bend the border a little bit.
That's okay.
Yeah, there you go.
That's right. What I've got to add or subtract or question is one of the things was how do you get certified organic? But it seems like it's more and more today, much more marketing than it is actually changing the way that you grow something or you alter the way that the terms are defined so that it satisfies the way that you're growing something. As opposed to changing the way you're growing something. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I listened to the last broadcast you guys had, and Don said, you know, really, organics and certified organics is a regulatory nightmare. I mean, you've got to go through a lot of paperwork. And really, the heart of it is, it's the same institute that is pushing GMO feed, you know, it's the USDA, it's the United States Department of Agriculture. So, I mean, they're regulating organics as well as, you know, having a Monsanto lawyer in charge of everything. So it's really, I think it's a matter of how you raise it. And again, taking the time to know the farmer and visit the farm and, you know, that sort of thing. So, hopefully that helps.
One other question on the ground here in central Minnesota in this area, do you know the guys at the locals Cub and Super Value stores? Do you converse with the managers or the owners, or is there any kind of back and forth that you guys can primarily you don't supply the volume that they need to furnish with their customers. But is there some way that you can nibble into the edge, or would your products not sell as well, you know, lined up against the cheaper stuff from Chile or transferred in from Australia or wherever?
Yeah, I don't think they would. They might sell as well, but see, again, I don't have the volume to go into a supermarket environment like that. And again, I don't think that as far as price, because I don't have the volume, that's another hurdle as far as marketing goes. In price, I have to charge more. So they would have to pay more, and then in turn, they would have to charge the consumer more. So you're talking $8 hamburger, you know? So most people aren't going to pay for that.
Right. They're not accustomed to
it. Well, how about... Here's I don't know if you're doing this, but actually marketing, since you have a unique product, why not market, for example, to restaurants, to exclusive or high-end restaurants, and, you know, knocking on their door, talking to the chef and saying, here's the benefits of this, and you can really, make a go of offering something different to your customers.
Yep, and we are. There is an establishment here in Baxter, Prairie Bay Restaurant. We have sold burger there, and we continue to. So, yeah, you know, we're trying to tap into that. The cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, it's huge. Local foods is huge down there. But, again, we're smaller that we just don't have the volume to supply, major markets like a restaurant. I mean, they push a lot of product through. Some of these restaurants. There's a gentleman that I rode with last year. He does beef. He sells one whole beef to this restaurant a week. So, I mean, massive volume. So again, we're growing from within. We're trying to stay away from borrowing, money and that sort of thing. So, there's a place where we're going to cap off, and I'd love to see more people doing it. So, it's not just us supplying the market. It's many, many farmers. So,
yeah, that was the next question, too, is that you're going to get to a point where there is only so much that you individually can do.
Correct.
So you have to hire somebody and then you have to, rent some more land and expand this way. And, yeah, I think the challenge is always, the thought flitted through my mind. There was an old book, a guy by the name of Schumacher wrote a book in the 70s called Small is Beautiful. And that was, in essence, his message. You get to a point where you can no longer be small if you want to have more, which is almost like a contradiction in terms. If you want a bigger car, bigger house, nicer place to live, more land, being small is a tough way to be. It's almost impossible.
But maybe being a family, run farm, a sustainable run farm, if folks would band together, so you get a lot of families together,
sure.
Form a co-op and then have a co-op marketing arm, which is probably just one person. So, all the families, in essence, hire a full-time person, and I don't know how many farms you would need in order to be able to do that. The full-time person goes out and markets your beef.
Mm-hmm.
And sure. Then you could supply, the big restaurants, for example. You could, maybe it's not your individual, maybe you're supplying one a month or one every 2 months, but the collection as a whole could, supply that particular restaurant with their needs and have a higher, and everybody gains in this particular case.
Yeah, and I think what's going to happen is more of the shrinkage from the other end. I think there are going to be more Detroits and more Philadelphias and more Californias that are going to collapse of their own weight. And we are going to get closer to the point where we have to grow our own food because there's no more big cities to go to buy it.
Boy, can you imagine what would happen if the grocery stores closed for a weekend? I can see riots in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a little extreme, but it could happen. It's not that far-fetched. And I think maybe we've made some progress. There's some good ideas here. There are some co-ops around the area here that work together. And I think as consumers, if we can take Abe's advice and start searching for local sources of food, not only for beef, but for raw milk, for organic vegetables, and maybe you don't need to look for certified on the label. If the label isn't a factor, if you've found your own sources and you're satisfied in your mind and in your heart that they're doing sustainable farming, doing things God's way, then you're confident in buying from them. So part of it is just being an astute consumer. And I think we can maybe give a big boost to this fledgling industry, which used to be the mainline industry in this country, and bring it back. And for those of you with the internet access, you can learn more about grass-fed beef and the Hollister Family Farm at hollisterfarm.com is Abe's website. And Abe, thanks so much for joining us today. We've learned a lot, and hopefully we can do this again sometime. Would you be up for that?
I would be, yes. Thank you guys so very much for doing this and educating the consumer. So I appreciate it.
And Don, thank you for your input. Always, always appreciate that. And I know we didn't get to talk a lot of science today. Appreciate having you around and you had some awfully good ideas. Maybe we can build on this as the weeks go by.
Well, thank you, Jim, and it's been fun as usual.
David, you were fun too.
Well, thanks. I've been told that was a good time. Yeah, yes, that's a good deal.
Thanks. Music on A Broken Road Radio Monday from James McCartney.